It's a long, difficult journey to some of the most contested waters in the world, to an ocean where a dangerous game of brinkmanship is underway.
China and Vietnam have begun official talks about their bitter territorial dispute in the South China Sea.
For 5 days, I'm embedded with the Vietnamese Coast Guard. It's stationed in viewing distance of the billion-dollar Chinese oil rig.
If you think about Vietnam, you probably think about a tourist destination, relatively cheap travel, great food, and perhaps a connection via the Vietnam War. But there is another story in Vietnam. How did it manage to recover from decades of war? Its economic transition from a socialist economy to one of the fastest growing market economies in Southeast Asia. And its role in the dispute over the South China Sea. Hello, I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN and via your ABC radio app. The Socialist Republic of Vietnam emerged in 1975, when North Vietnam defeated America and its allies and marched into Saigon, finally ending decades of war and conflict. Alexander Vu Vinh, from the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Centre for Security Studies, is speaking to me today in his personal capacity.
More than 40 years ago, when the Vietnamese communists came to Saigon and the Vietnam War, the country was devastated. There was war continuously in Vietnam. So we can talk about the first Indochina War from 1946 until 1954 between the Vietnamese and the French, basically, and then the Vietnam War from 1964 to 1975. But between that, there were also insurgents and small-scale war in South Vietnam. So there were continuously years of war and armed conflict. So basically, the country was devastated economically.
There were incredible scenes as thousands of Vietnamese crowded, pushed and squeezed to get on the American helicopters making their way out of the city, the last escape route from Saigon.
To the Americans with me, it's the last look at Vietnam. And any time now, it'll be the end of the American presence in Southeast Asia.
The war had dragged on for years and involved, as we all know, huge military intervention by the United States involving bombing, which of course caused a lot of destruction in urban and rural areas.
Ben Kirkbleet is an emeritus professor at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific.
In the South, as the war was ending, even more people than had previously moved around were trying to find some place that was reasonably safe. People moving from where they had been evacuating to other places where they thought they could evacuate, and some trying to get out of the cities, others trying to get into the cities. The North had been living under wartime conditions since the early 60s and certainly since the mid-60s. So it had less dislocation in terms of people moving around. But still, economically, things were in very bad shape in much of Vietnam, south, central, and north, way into the 1980s. Not only because of the war, but also having to do with problems in the northern economy even before the war ended that lingered, and the efforts by the new United government to establish new systems of markets and use of resources in the South that was running into all kinds of not outright resistance, but casual ongoing resistance.
North and South Vietnam had been separated for decades. Tuong Vu is professor of political science at the University of Oregon and the author of Vietnam's Communist Revolution.
There was two different countries, two different governments for 20 years before that. North Vietnam and South Vietnam had totally different economies. So the South was more like capitalist, whereas in the North, they had this Stalinist system of central planning and collective ownership of land and so on. So it was two different economic systems when the country was reunified under the communist regime in Hanoi. And what they did was trying to impose the system in the north on the south by what they call reforming the southern capitalist economy and making it like a socialist economy, just like in the north. So they ordered the collectivization of agriculture. They confiscated property belonging to what they call a capitalist class. And they tried to create that kind of centrally planned collective economy.
The communist government interned many South Vietnamese who had worked either for the Southern government or for the Americans.
Just a few weeks ago, the revolutionary government took away all the former officers of the South Vietnamese Army for re-education. They announced that this would be from 15 days to a month. Well, after 5 weeks, most of those officers hadn't come back, and the people got very, very nervous and tense, and the wives actually protested in a...
That's another issue, too, because many people with expertise, you know, in economy, in education, in social management, the new government policy was harsh on them. Many of them, especially those who worked for the Southern government before, were sent to education, re-education camp, which were practically hard labor camp for many years. Many did not come back for a decade later. So the whole Southern economy lacked the expertise, people with expertise to manage it. And that contributed to the economic problems as well. And then 2 or 3 years after their victory, many people decided that they could not live under the system anymore. So there were like hundreds of thousands of bold people trying to flee Vietnam.
Vietnam basically during a decade after the Vietnam War from 1975 until 1986, the model was Communist Party monopoly in the political system and also Communist Party monopoly in the economic system. But that was a big failure. The Vietnamese, during that first decade after the Vietnam War, the government faced with a very, very severe crisis and comprehensive crisis in domestic politics, in the economy, and also in foreign policies.
The running war between Kampuchea, formerly Cambodia, and Vietnam is being closely watched in the United States. President Carter's security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, describes the conflict as a proxy war between China and the Soviet Union, since China supports Cambodia and the Soviets Vietnam.
The Chinese authorities recently started a war of aggression against Vietnam.
Radio Hanoi announcing the Chinese invasion of Vietnam.
So remember, late 1978 and early 1979, Vietnam invaded Cambodia and toppled the Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia, but Vietnam also stayed in Cambodia, became a occupying force until 1989. Vietnam also fought a war with China along the border, so the West and China and ASEAN launched an offensive to isolate Vietnam diplomatically, boycott Vietnam economically. So Vietnam was living under severe sanction, diplomatic and economic sanction, by most of the rest of the world. So basically relied primarily on the lifeline from the Soviet Union. And then you have the Soviet Union undergoing a transformation which is called Perestroika and Glasnost. And then the collapse of the Soviet Union itself in 1991, the collapse of the communist countries in Eastern Europe. All these transformations also affected Vietnamese. And so for the Vietnamese itself, by 1986, they realized that they have to reform. And so they launched a very significant and comprehensive reform program in the late 1986. And from that time on, Vietnam has embarked on a long-term reform project where the Communist Party vows to reform the economic and political system in the country gradually, but they vow to reform economically and also politically, and that process is still ongoing right now.
That shift is actually over a period of years. I would say from the late 70s until the late 80s. So it wasn't all in one go. And it was not essentially a big policy decision by the government in Hanoi to say, okay, we're going to shift from a socialist command economy to a market economy. Those decisions gradually came to them in significant part for two reasons. One was what I call bottom-up pressure of people evading where they could, and over time evading often the efforts of the state market system to claim their time, their labor, their resources, their production, to the point that the collective farms became hollowed out by people appropriating collective resources, including land, to farm on their own. So that's one thing. The other big factor is that the command economy by the late 70s and into the 80s was not working well. Economic conditions were worsening for a lot of people, especially people in the cities, because food that was supposed to be extracted from the countryside wasn't being extracted and wasn't reaching urban markets. People were queuing for bits of rice and cooking oil and other sort of staples of a food for the family. Main commodities were being rationed. Difficulties of getting rationed goods was worse in the 80s than it had been during the war, pre-75 in the North. And that the system was making life very, very miserable contributed to policy choices and changes that built on what people were already doing with their feet, shifting the economy to a more market system. And fairly quickly, flow of goods, availability of important foods, and the like improved in the early 1990s.
People's lives are generally getting better here in Vietnam, but it's under one very strict condition, that no one questions the complete control of the Communist Party. Those who do risk a decade or more.
Well, I would say successful to some extent. Vietnam has become one of the fast-growing economies in the region, has become an emerging economy. Vietnam has also lifted millions of people out from poverty. So if we compare the economic life of the country today with the economic scene of the country in the 1970s and 1980s, there's a huge difference. You know, millions of people have been lifted from poverty. So it's a tremendous change in Vietnam. But still, the Communist Party is still trying to maintain control. And even though they realize that market forces are essential for the growth of the economy, for the health of the economy, but still the biggest companies in the country are state-owned, owned by the state. And the biggest banks in the country are also state-owned. The state sector in the country make up about 30% of the GDP, but they absorb 60 to 70% of the bank loans and the investment that the government pour into the economy. And that's why I would not say that Vietnam's economic story after the war is a success. I would say it's a half success. What we see is a steady growth of economy, but if you look at the potential, Vietnam could have been growing much more than just the 6% growth rate of the last couple of years. And also, if you compare with China, Vietnam's growth rate was still very modest.
And today, what's the economy based around, and how much of the economy is in private hands and how much is still in state hands?
About 35 to 40% of the economy is still in the state hands. And so the state-owned enterprises dominate key strategic sectors like electricity, like steel, like shipbuilding and telecommunication and so on. So all these strategic sectors in state ownership. And private companies in Vietnam tend to be small. They are competitive, but then they're not supported by the government at all. Most of the banks are state-owned, so they have to bribe a bank official to obtain a loan. And they don't have access to land, and all the land is owned by the state. So the state offers state-owned enterprises favorable treatment in terms of access to land and credits and other things, whereas the private sector in Vietnam is quite squeezed. and they don't enjoy any favourable treatment at all.
You're with Rear Vision on RN, online or via your ABC radio app. I'm Annabelle Quince and we're tracing the story of Vietnam from the end of the war in 1975.
Vietnam is a country of enduring mystique, a gentle land whose people proved tough enough to defeat some of the world's great powers. Beneath its romantic veneer, Vietnam is facing powerful new pressures from within. As in China, Vietnam's Communist Party is trying to keep power while unleashing a free market economy, and that's proving harder by the day.
Well, politically, Vietnam is much different today than it was in 1990. With the change in the economy and the receding role of the state in people's lives, where they could live, what kind of employment they could get, where they could be educated if they were to go to university, those kinds of decisions were less and less in the hands of state officials or the bureaucracy at different levels, and more in the hands of families and individuals. But over time, with this change in how the economy works and the receding of the state, more and more people are doing things among themselves. Groups and associations are formed around sports activities, religious groups, artist associations, people who have shared interests in bicycles, motor scooters, or what have you, who are coming together and doing things in a way that previously were not easy or even possible to do, or people didn't even have the economic means to devote some time and energy and other resources to these activities that didn't involve work and taking care of the immediate needs of a family. So that's one big change. A second is, in that process emerges much more public expressions of criticism of the government, of working conditions, of the school system, of many aspects of people's lives. Criticism that previously was there but could not be easily or safely voiced. One thing helping for this to happen was the growth of media outlets that the state no longer could control, the role of the internet in particular, and the emergence of people's abilities to use the internet and access to the internet. So you get blogs and discussion groups and exchange of emails and exchange of manuscripts of articles and essays and books that are not authorized by the state. But people now have the means to circulate these things, talk about these issues of common concern in very public ways that previously they couldn't. So politically, in my view, the situation in Vietnam is much more dynamic, much more alive, openly so, than it was in the early 1990s.
The trial of a high-profile Vietnamese human rights lawyer has highlighted Vietnam's treatment of activists. Since the start of this year, more than 50 people have been convicted and jailed in political trials.
Critics of the Vietnamese government are watched by the authorities, and so are their families. We visited Vietnam without permission to report and saw Le Quoc Quan's family under the cover of darkness. He's been in jail since December, leaving his young family alone.
Civil society has expanded quite quickly in the last decade, to the surprise of many. We have seen quite frequent protests in Vietnam these days. A few months ago, there was a protest that involved 10,000 farmers, which is for the first time quite a significant number. And the protest was led by two Catholic priests. And just yesterday, there was a protest involving about 1,000 people, also led by priests. So these protests came from Catholic communities in North Central Vietnam who were affected by large-scale pollution problem caused by foreign invested company with links to the state. So my point is that, you know, civil society has increased a lot, has expanded a lot in the last decade. In terms of opposition party, many groups have tried to form opposition parties since about 5-10 years ago, but they have all been arrested by the government, sent to prison for long terms. There's still effort today to organize an opposition, but mostly has been done online and within certain smaller communities. There's a movement among the prominent intellectuals to form a civil society movement to challenge the party. Last year, they collectively ran for the National Assembly, nominated themselves for the position in the National Assembly, and they declared that their goal was not to win because they knew they could never win. But then their goal was to show the people how the system was rigged, and they did that by documenting all the harassment and the physical threat that they received every step along the way as they tried to nominate themselves to be on the ballot for the elections.
Zhuang Tu Huang was a Communist Party member until she started writing novels on government corruption and the abuse of power. She writes with inside knowledge, which is probably why they once jailed her.
It has become a central issue in Vietnamese politics in the last 1 or 2 decades. I would say the corruption has become the mode of living of the regime itself. I use the term rent-seeking to describe that, in which the whole state in Vietnam, the government in Vietnam, the party in Vietnam, lived from negotiating with society, with the business world, and so living from basically selling permission. The way they do it is the government officials tries to produce a lot of barriers in the business and in the society. And so the business world and civil society, if they want to do their business, if they want to get permission to build a house, to open a business, to whatever they need to do, they have to renegotiate the law with the government officials. And so they have to pay the fee, unofficial fee, for getting the government officials to smooth the process for them. So that's the way you grease the machine. The regime lives from that, and that's the corruption, and that's what I call rent-seeking. And it has become the living mode, the way of life for the regime. In the last decades or so, top leaders in Vietnam have realized that corruption has become so destructive, and they declare fight against corruption. They say corruption is threatening the survival of the party, threatening the survival of the regime. So they have realized that, the top leaders. But at the same time, their own people are living from corruption. And so there is an internal fight within the ruling elite in which they have to maintain a level of corruption so that they can still maintain some healthy economy, and they can still maintain a fairly effective bureaucracy. But at the same time, they cannot get rid of corruption because their people live from corruption. And I don't see any way out of it.
A giant Chinese oil rig, which sparked deadly anti-Beijing riots in Vietnam, has finished its first round of drilling in disputed waters of the South China Sea. Tensions are continuing to escalate in the region, with Vietnam accusing a Chinese ship of deliberately ramming and sinking one of its fishing boats.
If the South China Sea is seen as the backyard for China, it's the front yard for Vietnam, it's the doorstep of Vietnam. Vietnam has tremendous stake in the South China Sea. A lot of time people think about the South China Sea dispute as a dispute over natural resources like oil and gas. In actuality, it's more than just that. Vietnam obviously has a lot of economic stakes in the South China Sea. There are a lot of oil and gas production of Vietnam. But for the Vietnamese, it's not particularly about oil and gas. It's more of a sense of security. The Vietnamese has been living with China for 2,000 of years, and they have experienced the security dilemma that they have with China, that they have to maintain a relationship with China where China's power is always overwhelming, and China can attack Vietnam anytime and can invade Vietnam anytime. So the Vietnamese are very security conscious. So this has become a complex issue where resources are intertwined with security issues and nationalist symbols.
A lot of Vietnamese, not just students, not just intellectuals or academics, are nervous, if not angry, hostile toward China because of China's aggression against Vietnam and confiscation of Vietnamese territory. The waters around Vietnam that are considered to be part of Vietnam's territorial waters, some of the islands that have long been regarded by Vietnamese as part of their country. China's activities, especially since 2005, 2006, in the South China Sea have increasingly really, really bothered a lot of Vietnamese. And they're worried, why isn't the Vietnamese government doing more to protect the territory of Vietnam, to protect Vietnam's waters and the islands?
So what impact are these changes likely to have on Vietnam, both politically and economically?
By and large, Vietnamese are reasonably content with the present political economic order, or at least not terribly discontented to the point that they are willing to either privately or publicly advocate a big change. I've never met any Vietnamese who would want a change, even people who are highly critical of the government, who would want a change that involves violent overthrow. The people who are talking about change are talking about trying to do it very peacefully, slowly, over time. Economically, things for most people have been much better over the last couple of decades. I think Vietnamese concerns are, how do I keep my family together, improve their education, improve our housing, our standard of living? And that doesn't involve major changes in the political system.
Ordinary people just want to live their lives and just want to, they need stability, they need peace. But at the same time, the sentiment on the grievances just accumulated. So you don't see any signs of revolt today, so it won't be a revolt tomorrow. No, the thing is that it just accumulated, the grievances. And the government, because they are incompetent, they see the urgency, they have to act, they have to reform, but at the same time, they don't want to lose their power, they don't want to lose control, and they stick to their outdated mode of governance, which is very unfit to the reality of the 21st century, where people are connected through social media and people have very different dreams than, you know, their parents or grandparents of the past. So the government the ruling elites in Vietnam basically are running out of options.
Professor Alexander Vuving from the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii. My other guests, Professor Tuong Vu, author of Vietnam's Communist Revolution, and Ben Kirkblit, Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University's College of Asia and the Pacific. If you're podcasting this program, think about rating us or leaving a review on iTunes or your podcasting app. The sound engineer is Judy Rapley. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.